My name is John Schramm, and this session is called The Disarmed Life. On the whiteboard behind, you have also a title, Gentle Justice, which is the Holden theme for the summer, Toward a Healthy Spirituality. Some of you can't see that, but I'll bring you up to date if I write anything else on that whiteboard. I'm here several weeks, and every session that I do is going to be under that title, Gentle Justice Toward a Healthy Spirituality. So it's simply pieces of that general topic. Spirituality is a kind of new in-word, a buzzword, especially among Protestants. So I would like, as I put some other things on the whiteboard, for you to visit with one other person about what spirituality says to you. What does it mean to you? Free associate, for you won't need more than 30 seconds, but just share what spirituality says to you while I get some other things on the board. Well, we've got 2 weeks, but I hope to give you time to do some. Let's have about half a dozen responses to get some variety. The first session, the Bible study this morning, had good response, and I was pleased with that. So, spirituality, yes.
I think it means the Holy Spirit working in your life, making His presence known,
okay.
Knowing that He's going to grab you by the nap of the neck sometimes.
All right, the Holy Spirit's activity in your life. Sometimes it's a grabber. Somebody else. A lot of you were talking. It's not pass fail.
What I heard from my person that I was listening to is he said that he thinks of radio waves, and he thinks of a transmitter and a receiver, and a person who has spirituality is a receiver.
Okay, thank you. That's a good image, visual image, not just a definition. Yes.
Spirituality is related to the spirit.
Thank you. Okay. That's three straight males. How about some feminist spirituality? Yes.
I said it's a any time we practice a conscious contact with God or dependence on God, not sort of automatically assuming that it's there, but it's when I'm aware of it. And,
okay. Thank
and
you.
By whatever method.
Thank you. Yes.
It's a term that I think frequently is used to bootleg a lot of personal agenda.
Okay. Thank you. I will put you in good company. William Stringfellow says the word is a trick. It's a clergy trick so that they can talk about something when they have nothing really to say.
I see spirituality is basically just dealing with our being. All
okay.
Aspects of who we are, what we're about, and our relationship to the Lord.
Okay, thank you. That's a very good variety, by the way, and I'm sure all of you have some input that you could have given. It is a kind of tricky word. I think it's worth moving into the word and having a new understanding of it, even though it can bootleg or can be a clergy trick. And so I would like to have it as the overall theme for the time we're together. And I have some things that we're going to work with the whole time. I put gentle justice in the middle. I think it's always helpful to find out where the center is for someone's spirituality. That doesn't mean that's the entire spirituality, but every spirituality has a center. It doesn't take long. It wouldn't take long for you, and it doesn't take long while you're talking to someone. Someone's center could be going to heaven after you die, and you will find in definitions of salvation, definitions of who Jesus is, what is part of their faith life, you'll know where the center is. The center can be some right doctrine. Never find that at Holden among Lutherans, but it's possible that that's the center for somebody, having their doctrines orthodox, not really realizing that the word orthodoxy is to have your praise straight. Not have your doctrine straight, it's to have your worship straight. straight, orthodoxy, doxology. But Lutherans could have the idea of the right doctrine. It could be everyone sharing the same religious experience. That's the center of someone's spirituality. Or having the right C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L. I'm putting the Holden theme in the center, gentle justice. Another way, and a way that I would use more normally in my teaching, would be active reconciling nonviolence is at the center of my understanding of New Testament spirituality. You would then know where I'm coming from. Matthew Fox puts creation at the center of spirituality as he writes. I think it's very helpful that he writes with a creation-centered spirituality, and I think it's very helpful that he tells us up front where the center is. Do you see what that's not right or wrong, it's just that it's important to know the center, and as we're talking about it, you'll know what the center is for these sessions. That the perimeter, I have 4 points. Raleigh Martinson at Luther Seminary said, if you read the things that Martin Luther said about spirituality, these are the 4 pivotal points that Luther thought were important for a healthy spirituality. You'll find in some of them a reaction against monasticism. But I think you'll also find some very helpful things, and what we'll do each time is to start with one of them and link them maybe to the others, but over the period of the weeks that we're doing it, we'll keep going around the circle on word, the world, community, and solitude. My premise is you probably major in one of these or 2 of these, and growth for you may come in expanding and finding some. If you tend to be very active in the world, you may have a great growth experience to move into silence, solitude, meditation, contemplation, that might be growth for you. If you tend to live in community and surround yourself with people, it may be that the time of silence is very important for you. If you are a very withdrawn person, it may be that growth for you is to get out into the world and to relate to some other people and stop living in your head all of the time. But what we're going to do is to link these. We could have arrows. Link these in all kinds of ways, but the center is gentle justice. Today, the first presentation, the disarmed life, starts at the top of that circle, the word. I was delighted. How many were at the Bible study? Lots? Yeah, okay. I was delighted, we did not plan this ahead of time, that Mary had a little discussion on word. And somebody got an A+, in fact, somebody up in the balcony, because the second answer was Jesus, the incarnate word. If you were not aware of it, Mary's description of word was not because she comes from the Roman Catholic Church and isn't really a Lutheran yet. That was very Lutheran. Robert Geiser at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary said, Luther never put an equal mark between word and Bible, never. He did not make those 2 things equal, synonymous. And she went on to talk about Luther referring to the manger that holds the Christ. Luther did put equal signs between word and promise, word and grace, word and Jesus. So if your Lutheran understanding is much more equating word and Bible, you may not be as Lutheran as you think. I think sometimes there are Lutherans who merge over into a tradition, again, not right or wrong, but a tradition much more of biblicism or fundamentalism that has not been the historic roots. So when I use word today, I'm referring primarily to the incarnate word, Jesus. So let's talk a little bit about the disarmed life and gentle justice. When I talk about the disarmed life, I have a norm, and the norm is Jesus. I want to share a couple ways in which other people said this. This is John Howard Yoder, a Mennonite scholar, and I'm quoting. The Christian whose loyalty to the Prince of Peace puts him or her out of step with today's nationalistic world because of a willingness to love one's nation's friends but not to hate the nation's enemies is not an unrealistic dreamer who thinks that by one's objections all wars will end. It is rather the military who think that they can put an end to wars by preparing for just one more. Nor does the Christian think that by refusal to help with the organized destruction of life and property, one is uninvolved in the complications and conflicts of modern life. Nor is the Christian reacting simply in emotional fear to the fantastic awfulness of the weapons created by the demonic ingenuity of modern humanity. The Christian loves one's enemies not because he or she thinks they are wonderful people, nor because it is thought that love is sure to conquer them, not because the believer fails to respect one's native land or its rulers, nor is unconcerned for the safety of one's neighbors, nor because another political or economic system may be favored. The Christian loves his or her enemies because God does and commands those who follow to do so. That's the only reason, and that is enough. For me, the norm, if I'm talking about gentle justice or talking about active, reconciling nonviolence, is Jesus, the one that I call Lord. A woman wrote it this way. She lived in the Federal Republic of Germany. Jesus Christ lived without protection. That's not a statement of faith. That's an observation. He renounced the protection of family offers. He did not want the protection afforded by property. He did not use the protection of rhetoric, but remained silent. He expressly rejected the protection of weapons and armies. When Peter wished to defend him against being taken prisoner, he said, "Put your sword back into its place. For all who take the sword will perish by the sword." Christ reveals God as love that offers itself. God has no desire to keep protected and unapproachable. God practices no violence. God has disarmed in Jesus Christ unilaterally. The first description of those who were those who said Jesus is Lord, the first description was followers of the way. The first description was not those with a similar religious experience or those with a particular piety. It was those who were followers of the way. And I think if you really study the New Testament and study the early Christian history, the primary ingredient of what that way was forgiveness that absorbed hostility, radical forgiveness that absorbed hostility, and servanthood that replaced domination. In other words, gentle justice. If you want to understand both the reason Christianity spread and the reason that it was persecuted and the essence of what it was, when you take Jesus as the norm, I think you will find that it's active reconciling nonviolence. We in our tradition of looking at the peace war issue as Lutherans use the justifiable war criteria, and they come from Greek philosophy. We have never claimed that they came from Jesus. Reinhold Niebuhr said that you could not, he was not a pacifist, by the way. He wrote a very articulate tract on why the Christian is not a pacifist. If you think that intelligent people have not written tracts against pacifism, his is very articulate. But in it, he never claims that you can prove a stance of violence by pointing to Jesus, driving the money changers out of the temple, or saying, "We have two swords and that's enough," or some such thing. Never, he says, can you prove it. But the point is, you can't follow Jesus in a fallen world. That's Niebuhr's argument. It's not against Jesus being the norm of gentle justice. It's against the possibility of taking that norm in the ambiguities and the brokenness of this world. But I'm saying, if we want a spirituality that is a healthy one and a New Testament one and a faithful one, let's look to Jesus, who is the norm. The pastoral letter by the bishops of the Roman Catholic Church, I thought, was very refreshing. I don't know how carefully you've studied them. We probably don't take them real seriously in most Protestant congregations. First of all, I think the way they did it was healthy, to have it go out and have people respond to it and get a change. There's as much helpfulness in discussing something as in passing it. Have you ever heard of a lot that happened after you passed the resolution of the church convention? It got filed somewhere. It was the floor debate that helped us grow, not this document. The pastoral letter on peace was a very helpful one. But so was Dan Berrigan's comment. Daniel Berrigan can be poetic and caustic, I'm aware of that. But his comment was, I looked over to see who they interviewed in writing that letter. And he said, for the life of me, I don't know why we needed so many people from the State Department to tell us what the Bible says and what Jesus says. That's more than just being facetious. That's a legitimate response. He even added, it's like St. Peter consulting with Pilate during Holy Week. Now he's meddling, and he's gonna have a fight on his hand, I'm afraid, with that one. My point is, just listen how often something else other than Jesus is the norm for our spirituality. Some other cultural value, some other philosophical system. My point is that I want to live in a church that has Jesus as the norm. I'm going to do that with a story. I think sometimes stories are the best way to get at the truth and even to talk about spirituality. Is there anybody else in here who has read Brother to a Dragonfly? That's pretty good. Three or four. Let me tell you what the book is before I tell the story. Will Campbell is one of the most refreshing people that's around today. He is a redneck, and he's glad to be. He understands Southern people who are working in the field and have a redneck because of that. He is the editor of a magazine called Catalogate, and you cannot label it conservative or liberal, or it's refreshing because it will not be in a box. He worked for voter registration in the South, and he also worked among the Ku Klux Klan. So he was despised by everybody because he just wouldn't go in somebody's camp. And this book is one of the most touching stories I have ever read about Will and his brother Joe. And he refers to his brother Joe as a dragonfly. And you'd have to read the book. It's a tragic life that his brother had, but the book is just marvelous. I was delighted when I saw a list of incoming seminarians to Wartburg Seminary in Dubuque, Iowa, were during the summer before entering to read Brother to a Dragonfly. I thought they will have some sense of the gospel when they get to seminary. Now for the story. Will, at this point in the book, is working for voter registration and working among the blacks, and so he's obviously under great criticism by the white people that were his friends and that he knew, and his brother Joe, who is a pharmacist, is also criticized because he's Will's brother. But the most refreshing character in this anecdote is P.D. East. P period, D period, East. He is a cantankerous, sharp-tongued, sarcastic, atheist lawyer. And he is on Will all the time. You can just feel it. The dialogue is, whenever anything bad happens, PD says, I wonder what Mr. Jesus would say about that, Will. Just pours in. And PD is always on Will. He said, Will, if you could define Christianity in 10 words or less, and I could understand it, maybe I'd be one. And he's always on Will. Get it down to 10 words or less and words that I understand, and I might be a Christian, Will. And he's always referring to Christians as Easter chickens. The story went back to where their family got a chicken for their daughter, and it was purple. And everybody said, look at this, we've got a purple chicken. And they put it out in the backyard, and all the other chickens stayed away, and it didn't get in the pecking order right away. It was different. He said it took about 2 weeks, and that chicken wasn't purple at all. When the feathers started coming out, it was a Rhode Island red. And it took about another week, and it had accommodated. You couldn't tell the Easter chicken from any other chicken in the lot. That's what your Christians are like, Will. How would you like to have a friend like that daily on your case? Well, Will finally wanted to get rid of this haranguing question, so one day, they had probably had a beer or two, PDE said, hey, Will, you've never given me the definition of Christians in 10 words or less so that I could understand it. Will said, I can do it tonight, and I'll use only 8 words. We're all bastards, but God loves us anyway. And PD, for the first time of his life, was interested in the possibility of being a Christian. No, he really said, Will, that's amazing. I might be one. That's the background. Now the incident. There was, according to Will Campbell, one of the most beautiful young men he had ever met, Jonathan Daniels, an Episcopal seminarian, who had come down to register black voters in Hayville, Alabama. He had come down with a Roman Catholic priest and some other students. They were arrested, along with some black people that were working for voter registration. They were put in a county jail, and no provision at all was taken on the day they were released from jail. So when they got out of jail, here were two white people, two black people on the street of Hayville, and an off-duty deputy sheriff named Thomas Coleman came by with a rifle hanging in the back of his pickup truck, and he saw these integrationists, and he started firing. The two black students got away. The Roman Catholic priest, I think, was wounded and not sure died, but Jonathan Daniels was killed and was lying dead in the street. So Will came home and he didn't know that. And his brother Joe said, Will, do you know a Jonathan Daniels? And Will said, do I know Jonathan Daniels? I don't think I have ever seen a young man that I've loved anymore or wished he were my son. And Joe said, he's dead. Will just kind of crumbled in the seat. He said, he's dead. And Joe went through this whole story of how it happened. Will just put his hands in his head in his hands, and P.D. East moved in. And he said, Will, what was our working definition of Christianity? And Joe said, for God's sake, P.D., let him alone. And P.D. said, no, if you have a working definition, it's supposed to work. No matter what happens. Is that not right, Will? Will said, I guess. He said, if I remember, it's we are all bastards, but God loves us anyway. Is that right, Will? I guess. Was Jonathan Daniels a bastard, Will? Will said, I think he was the most beautiful. I don't want you to describe how beautiful the young man was. I want to know if your working definition works. Was he a bastard? Finally, Will said, yeah. P.D. said, how about Thomas Coleman, the off-duty deputy sheriff? That one was easy. Will said, yep. And then P.D. moved in, and he put his bony fingers on Will's knee, and he got about 3 inches from his face, and he said, okay, Will, which bastard did God love the most? And Will said, he got up, and he whirled around the room. He bounced off walls and windows, and he laughed and cried all at the same time. He realized that P.D. East, that sarcastic, caustic atheist, was doing something that Baptist Sunday School, seminary, and all the churches he had gone to in all the world hadn't done yet. He was converting Will to Christianity because he was making all the connections. If loved, then reconciled. If reconciled, then part of the family. If part of the family, then part of me. The ministry to the Ku Klux Klan was born at that moment in that room. And Will whirled around the room, and he laughed, and he cried, and he stopped and said, P.D., I used only 8 words. I'm going to use the other 2, and I'm going to use them right now. We're all bastards, and you're the biggest bastard of them all. And P.D. said, what do you mean? What did I do, Will? He said, you're about to make a Christian out of me, and I don't think I can stand it. That's what spirituality is. That's what healthy spirituality is. It's not running off somewhere, and it's not bootlegging, and it's not faking when you have nothing else to say. It's when you have some sense that something's about to make a Christian out of you and you don't think you can stand it. I'm coming down heavy on the justice side. That didn't sound so gentle, did it? I think those who chose the Holden theme meant to have it a tension all summer. But I think that story has helped me understand enemy love better than any story I've ever heard. And it is not theoretical. It may be theoretical if you ask me, do I do that? I don't do that well. I don't do it with a neighbor that irritates me because she has not yet once, while we've lived in Minneapolis, gotten all the way to the trash can and I have to pick up her garbage. I don't do well with the slightest irritations, but it is not theoretical. Meaning, are there people who have lived that? Or has that been the seed of the church? It has been. I'll tell you one other story. I heard a black man from South Africa named Pastor Farisani. I don't know if he ever got out west or not. He was in the Midwest and gave some speaking. Humble. He had been tortured for months in South African prisons. And he said, people asked me, where did you find your courage? And he said, oh, I am so embarrassed when they asked that. If only they could have been there when they tortured me, my knees shook. I was like a small child. I had no courage whatsoever. The only reason I'm alive and sane is I did what Jesus said to do. I had a prayer list. And each day I started, first of all, with those who tortured me. And I spent all the time it took praying for my enemies. Then I prayed for those who were the reason I was in jail that I had never seen. I took all the time it took. That's what Jesus said to do. Then I prayed for my, if there was any time left over at the end of the day, I prayed for myself, but there usually wasn't. Humble, direct testimony, not of courage, but of what happens when Jesus is the norm. That's what we're talking about. If you've never heard me before, they say I have a lecture and I sit here, but I really am a preacher. And I feel the difference. So if you'll know that if it's preaching that I finally will settle back and realize that I'm supposed to sit here and kind of coolly give out facts. But once in a while, you'll find that I just can't do that. Secondly, in the disarmed life, Jesus is the norm. But the world is our reality. Make no mistake about that. I'm not talking about some kind of spirituality that takes you out of the world. If Jesus is the norm and the world is our reality, that's where the tension comes in. Let me say what I mean. For 6 years, I did a national ministry for peace and nonviolence for the American Lutheran Church. During much of that time, I would sit with groups when we were on retreat and say, we've got to come up with another term instead of nonviolence. Do you realize we have a negative term? Do you realize how long it takes if you want to tell somebody what you mean by nonviolence? You have to undo it because it's a negative. It's the absence of something. And I would go through how Mahatma Gandhi, he had a word for nonviolence, ahimsa. Himsa is violence. You put an A on the front and it's nonviolence. Their language is very much like ours. You can do that sometimes in our language, get an antonym out of it. But he coined a word, he created a word, satyagraha, truth power, soul power, so that you knew it was an active, not the absence of something, but that it was an active reconciling. And I said, we have to come up with some word so that we have a way of saying it and not nonviolent. That's not my intent anymore, to help people try to find that or to find it myself. I think it's a very helpful thing that the only way we can talk about Jesus being the norm is to talk about non-violence, because what it says is our reality is violence. And we have to have something non-cultural reality in order to understand it. I'm willing to take the time of telling people, if Jesus is the norm, it means you have to be in dissent to the cultural reality of violence. That came home strong to me once. Mary and I had the opportunity to teach one day in Cameroon, in Maiganga, Cameroon. And here were these eager seminarians who had walked miles from their village to be at this seminary, and they were so apologetic. We were from the United States. I don't know if Simonson's had this same thing or not. We were from the United States. Therefore, since it was from the United States that they had heard about the gospel, Jesus, and the Bible, they thought we had it absolutely perfected back here. I mean, if anybody came from the U.S., they had perfect faith because that's where they had heard it from. So they were very apologetic that they said enemy love is not culturally accepted here. Our tribes do not love one another. And here they were so apologetic that they lived in a culture that was not perfectly nonviolent yet. And we had to be the ones to bring them the news about the United States. We were not at that time able to tell them that our president said communism is the source of all evil in the world, but we could at least tell them we had not perfected yet in this country nonviolence. Okay? And I do not mean romantic idealism or naivete. One of my inspirations is the Trinity Lutheran Congregation, where I serve, lost its building 20 years ago. And it's a group of Lutheran Free Church people who said, there's already enough church buildings in Minneapolis. We won't rebuild a church. So they changed their name from Trinity Lutheran Church to Trinity Lutheran Congregation, and we've never owned a building since. We've been in the mixed blood theater. That's pretty hard to tell people where you worship. We were in a place called the People's Center. Well, that was a little better. And now we are in Our Lady of Perpetual Help Roman Catholic Church, not Perpetual Responsibility. Our Lady of Perpetual Help, and have been for 16 years. So we share completely all of the facilities and all of the costs. It makes sense for two small parishes. We even worship together four or five times a year. Walking past this Trinity Lutheran Our Lady parish is Mulford Sibley, an old Quaker who teaches at the University of Minnesota, quite well known in the Midwest. He is a gem of a person. And I heard him give a talk on nonviolence once, and someone in the audience said, the trouble is you're just too naive. You don't know what the real world is like. You don't know the extent of evil. And Mulford Sibley paused and smiled and said, oh, no, no, no. Understood. It isn't that we who believe in nonviolence have never seen evil. It's that we have seen it so clearly in all of its frightening dimensions. We have seen it in all of its horror. We've seen it so clearly that we refuse to have any part of it, consciously, any part of it in our response to it. That's not naivete. I think that's the essence of the New Testament spirituality, if you read it again. Not naive, romantic, idealists, off in little enclaves enjoying one another, but refusing to participate in the violence of the world because they had another norm. They had Jesus as the norm. Faith is not a stubborn belief in spite of the evidence. You know that? Faith is not a stubborn belief in spite of the evidence. That's foolishness, not faith. Faith is risking in spite of the consequences. That's very different. And I think sometimes we get our young people to think that faith is to believe no matter how clearly it's something else, and to have them think that this is just an unreal world that we're inviting them in catechism or something. Okay. That's part two.
Could you repeat?
Faith is not stubborn belief in spite of the evidence. That's a good description for foolishness, not faith. It's not a stubborn belief in spite of the evidence. It's risk in spite of the consequence. Got it? I don't know who asked. Okay. What we've done in today's gentle justice in the disarmed life is to have a source or a norm, namely Jesus. And we've talked about the fact that you live that out in the world, and that it is, and that world is in fact violent. I love the quote. It's an E.B. White quote, and I've paraphrased it. So don't put it down and put E.B. White after it. It's my own version. He says, in the morning I look out, and it is a crummy, crummy, crummy world out there. Or start with the newspaper and the TV, or the number of sirens that woke you up, or the domestic quarrel next door, whatever. It's a crummy, crummy, crummy world. And he said, and it's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful world out there. And so I don't know whether to fight the injustice or to smell the flowers, and it makes it very hard to plan my day. I think spirituality has to have that tension, in fact, has to pull it so tight like a violin string that life sings. So I'm not trying to get rid of the tension. I'm building in the tension of a healthy spirituality. The third thing I'm going to do today is, if Jesus is the norm and violence and the world of violence is our reality, our own community is the turf where we begin to live this out. I've chosen words very carefully today. I put word at the top, not Bible. In fact, sometime in the series on spirituality, I'm going to do a session on let's stop having Bible studies. I think that's one of our problems, and I hope that day that title will make more sense and not sound facetious when you're done. It may sound facetious before we have it. And I have consciously said community, not church. And I hope we can have a good discussion on that one yet this week. One of the reasons that I put community and not church, I had church down there. It's a good word, ecclesia, the called out ones. I'm not unhappy with the word. But I just read Habits of the Heart. And Habits of the Heart has the claim that we do not have an alternative to individualism in the United States anymore. We have only varieties of it. And I think that book makes a very strong case for that. And the part that got me, I'm a professional paid word producer, and I'm a professional religious person, so my life is in the church. I get paid for going to places where you talk about things. I have some worker friends who can't believe that all of us keep going and meeting other people at Holiday Inns, and we call that the church at work. But anyway, the part that got to me the most was, somebody can be individualistic, make their million by the time they're 40, and they've lost that first marriage, the kids are on drugs, and so the next era is a generative person, and gardening, and jogging, and time with the family. It's just another way that serves better your individualism. You found that the other didn't work. But then he gets to church, and he said, and some have found that their individualism is best served in groups. Claims that's what we have in the church. We don't have communities, we have people's individualisms being served in a group. And I hope we take that one real seriously. So when we get to why this word is chosen instead of church, we'll have a whole day on that. But I do believe that we will not have more to offer the world and the reality of violence than we offer to one another in our own communities. I think we're kidding ourselves if we think we're going to be the ones to bring the norm of gentle justice and the norm of a disarmed life out into a nearly hardened, nearly deadened world if we can't even show that kind of love and forgiveness and whatever else it takes to have a disarmed life in our very communities where we share a faith. And I'm not sure that we do so well if you test us on that, as most communities. What do I mean by that? If we say that we are to pray for enemies, I would think that our liturgies and our services regularly prayed for enemies as part of the prayer. What I'm saying is that we should look for and build more congruence between what we say and what we do. If in our catechism instruction, our spirituality does not necessarily center only in right doctrine, let's go back, you can look this. When I was here, Dan Erlander did tapes on 3rd century Christian baptism that were just outstanding. And it's fairly clear now that for like 2.5 years, the catechumen, the one to come into the Christian faith who was seeking baptism, studied what it meant to be followers of the way. And the doctrine was the last 3 weeks. It was called the opening of the ear. And you learned the Lord's Prayer and the Creed and some other things. But it was this understanding of what it meant to be followers of the way that was the primary instruction. I think our catechism ought to help young people understand Jesus' norm and what it means to live in a violent world as part of the initiation rite for our young people. If we are going to be a church that talks about gentle justice, I would think the church ought to be less hierarchical. I think that's one of the things that the feminist movement is bringing in and calling into question, is the hierarchical system of the church. Some people say we have a business model. I don't think we are as good as most businesses. I was in Washington, D.C. when the American Lutheran Church took on management by objective, MBO, and I had federal employees living next door and said, my goodness, we gave that up a decade ago. It's dehumanizing for people. We were 20 years behind the federal government in understanding.
LCA did it at Houston a few years ago.
Yeah. Well, I thought there was hope for the LCA. I knew there wasn't for the federal. And one more thing on this point. And when we do some of these, and pray for the Holy Spirit's work, let that include common sense and good humor. The kind of thing, I remember a parish, a pastor friend of mine went to a little parish, and he wanted to bring in the green hymnal. And did he have a fight on his hands? So, and the whole congregation said, no way, we like this red hymnal. Well, one day they walked in, and in the pew racks were the green ones and the red ones. And he said, he got up front, and he said, would you all take out the green hymnal? And he said, would you hold it out in front of you? They all did. He said, about 8 or 10 inches from your mouth. They all did. He said, would you all go? He said, would you put those back and let's use the red hymnal? They all agreed. Well, about 4 weeks later, they could use the green one. That's what they wanted to do. They wanted to give it the raspberry. And why can't we use the imagination and the humor for our life together that we have at other times in our life? Why does that kind of go deadened when we come into church? Roy Bloomhorst was a pastor friend of mine in Washington, D.C. at a Missouri Synod Church, First Trinity, downtown, right downtown. And during the Vietnam era, there weren't many Lutheran students who came to protest in D.C. The Lutherans generally were not the activists, but I think it was the Cambodia invasion. There was a point at which students who had never protested before just descended on D.C. It was just like, that's too much, and I can't go along and not say something. So they called him up on Saturday night at 10 o'clock. They were Missouri Synod youth from the Midwest and said, can we sleep in your church? He didn't have time to call all the church council or to take a vote. He said, yeah. And he went down, opened the door, and when the parishioners came, it was filled with sleeping protesters at the early service. You had to step over them to get into our church. Well, Roy used good sense. The sermon that day, instead of the prepared one, was, why are all these people sleeping? I say use good sense because Walter Ruther was a Lutheran in Wheeling, West Virginia, all of his life until the Depression. The stock market fell. He went to his Lutheran church, and the pastor did not change one iota of a very fine doctrinal sermon on the doctrine of the Holy Trinity and did not mention what was on everybody's mind, and Walter Ruther was a Lutheran no more from that day on. So sometimes you have to say, and the Lutheran preacher used good sense and preached on. All right, anyway. He preached on why they were there, how he made the decision. Well, most people, Roy was well-liked, well-respected, most people were doing all right, but he saw one coming at him. He was standing here, and the person was as far away as he could get, trying to get out the door over here, and Roy reached over and said, hi, and he said, the other man said, I am so angry, I can't even talk. And Roy said, could you by Wednesday night? And the man didn't know at first what he meant. Roy said, I'm just asking how long it takes for your fuse to die down. Could you talk Wednesday night? And Roy spent 3 hours. Both were pastoral acts, letting the students sleep on the floor and spending 3 hours with a parishioner upset with the students sleeping on the floor. Both were pastoral acts. That's what I mean. Somehow, getting the good grace to bring up, not to retreat from controversial issues, but to realize our human frailties and to, well, And when you give them hell, they all know you love them. Do you know the difference between having somebody give you hell and somebody give you hell where you know they love you? I think that means speaking the truth in love or something. Somehow, I think we have to find ways, because if you hadn't recognized it yet, you certainly know by now, it's not very subtle. Spirituality is all of the things that we've been talking about. Spirituality, in fact, in planning the 10 sessions that I had, I stayed away from solitude for the first one, because we will tend to think more of contemplation, solitude, meditation, quiet walks. I come to the garden alone. Read your hymnal, and we have a lot of stuff about what spirituality is, and we may have a harder time understanding good humor, or Will Campbell and P.D. East, or the violence of the world and the incarnation as also part of our spirituality. I'm going to give you only one piece of that kind of technical lecture at this point, and then we're going to quit. Spirituality is not an easy word for us to move into in our own language, and I'll give you a reason for that. We use it in two very different ways. We use it in common conversation in two very different ways. Most of you, I don't see any Holden miners. They're on a scavenger hunt because they all came to my living room at Chalet 5 and I didn't know anything about a scavenger hunt. When I was their age, I won't tell you how long ago that was. When I was their age, if someone said, "Hey, how are you getting along with so-and-so," and named a young woman, and I said, "Strictly spiritual," everybody would have known what I meant. Of my peers, would you? It meant no sex. It meant we're friends, but no touch. Non-material, spiritual. If you look it up, that is the Greek understanding of spiritual, non-material. So you would not have very earthy, political, economic dimensions to your spirituality. But the Hebrew is very earthy and political. And we do get that in our own language. If last night, Lodge 6, I haven't been gone so long that I don't remember some of these things, if Lodge 6 had a spirited party, you all know what that meant. It was alive, probably loud, and that's the same word. So what I'm getting at is, when we keep opening this up day after day, you will find that part of your understanding of spirituality will be whether or not you really have that kind of biblical Hebrew understanding of earthy, sensuous, political, economic, or whether you tend to be, and this is oversimplified to say tend to be Greek, that's really not fair to them, but at least Neoplatonic, and that's a Greek person that we tend to associate with that, Neoplatonic in your understanding of kind of idealistic, non-material, and I hope that our moving into spirituality helps you grow in an understanding of what that can mean for us, for the church, for your own life. And this is not to take away the first free associations that you did. We'll get into some of those more than we did today. Okay, we've got 10 minutes if this clock is running right. My assumption at Holden over a 6-year period of time here was there was a direct inverse relationship between the speaker saying how often the speaker said, "And we will leave time for discussion at the end," and how little you got. The more the teacher said, "And we're going to spend half the time." So I did not do that today, because I had to lay out a lot of stuff. I do hope that the rest of this week there will be close to 50-50 of some presentation and some discussion. But today that was not true. I know that. Okay. What's your reactions or your responses? Speak up just a little more so I don't have to repeat. Okay.
I'm just struck by the Will Campbell story.
Okay.
Because last time I was in Holden, that book I read, and that's the story that struck me.
Is that right?
Huh. And it was as a former Southerner trying to come to terms with how I deal with this issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it is a very pivotal. Hmm. You know,
thank you.
Affirm that.
Thank you. I, you want a suggestion from me today on a possible book, I really do think it's worth reading. For spirituality, for an understanding of the gospel, and just for a touching story of two brothers. It really is excellent. I don't think I had the bookstore order that, so I'm not sure they have
it. It's back there.
Okay. All right. Good.
If we would feel something like Thomas and Kempis, you'd only have to live in a monastery.
Okay. Does it sound to you? I had a woman come into St. Martin's Table, which is where I'm working now. We've moved to Minneapolis, and we have a bookstore restaurant, which is a Peace and Justice Center. And she started reading Thomas Merton. Well, it could be the same reaction. Or somebody reads Dorothy Day or something. And they're, instead of being inspired, they're intimidated. It's just so far beyond anything that you can do. Are we talking about something if Jesus is the norm? If the world is this violent, can you really, is Reinhold Niebuhr right? That you really can't have the norm of Jesus in a fallen world. That you really do have to go to a monastery, or at least we have to open up Holden for full time. We'll just stay here all the time, right? Is that the way you react to it, to what we said today, or to this material?
Well, I anxiously await for the connection of how you get from one to the other. Okay.
Do you make any connections yourself at this point?
I'm looking.
Okay. Yes.
One of the things that I always struggle with is I have no problem accepting and trying to follow Jesus as a norm. The problem I have is rather that's really feasible and sensible and are practical to try to urge a government to follow that policy.
Okay.
Whether it's workable at a national and international level.
Okay. That's a very different question, but it's a key one. Maybe the ultimate question that you come down to is the relationship of church and world, of whether or not the church, instead of, that would be another way to say it, instead of all of us being in a monastery, maybe some people feel from what I've said today that the church has to separate itself much more from culture. Have you heard of Richard Niebuhr's five typologies of the relationship between the church and the world? He gave five different ways, and one of them is to separate. That has tended to be more Anabaptist or more Mennonite, and Lutherans have tended to be more of making the best of a bad situation. And there are other traditions that try to baptize the whole thing and run the world, run the government, theocracy. And he has two kind of in between there. But that's a key question. Would that be easier, do you think, if we were not trying to change the government, if we were simply being faithful, no matter what it cost? Does it make it easier?
Well, I suppose one possible approach is that each as more and more individuals affect more and more individuals towards becoming more and more in tune with the principles of Christ.
Yeah.
That ultimately a government would become more that way.
Mm-hmm.
I can just imagine though if Ronald Reagan, or as Jimmy Carter tried to run the government based on Christian principles, mm-hmm. and see how he got in big trouble economically and in all other kinds of ways.
Mm-hmm.
I just really wonder if those principles will work on an international level.
Nixon turned China around very rapidly.
Yeah.
And they are now our friends.
I think it's possible, Bill, that this could be a form. Are we glad Mark Hatfield is in the Senate? Or by the time you get to be a senator, have you made so many compromises that you can't be happy that anybody's there, whether the person professes to be a Christian or not? That's a viable debate. I mean, that really is. That's not so simple that obviously one answer is right or not. That's a really tough one. The material that I brought does not really have that, but it sure connects with what we're going to be doing in regard to spirituality. Tomorrow, contemplation and global justice is trying to make one of the connections that you're looking for. What would it mean to be a contemplative? Would it mean retreating to a monastery and seeing some different world, or does it mean seeing this world differently? And that the place, Luther is very strong, and this is, I'm sure, a reaction to the monastery. This one's reaction to the monastery by saying, you really do have to live in the world. Don't retreat from it. This is, of course, what we know as Luther's high regard to the words of Jesus. Living Word is probably one of the best legacies Luther left. community. Luther did leave one, an Augustinian one, but always had a high regard. And we're going to have a session on new monasticism that I think holds some possibilities. And this is the one that we've thought Luther left and have not seen how influenced he was by Tauler and by the mystics. Bengt Hoffmann has a book, Luther and the Mystics, which was one of the first to show that Luther did not leave all of that at all, but I think by combining it with the others, you have a healthier spirituality. That's just, again, some preview. Yes?
I don't have so much trouble seeing Luther at those opposite extremes, but I have a lot of trouble when we try to do a free association and say that Luther is at that juncture of gentle justice when I know what he said about the peasants' revolt and so on.
Yeah. Okay. I do not turn to Luther for my basis in nonviolence. You're right. I don't find it there. So when we have a session on nonviolence, it will not have quotes from Luther or turn to Luther. We'll turn to Gandhi, it'll turn to St. Francis of Assisi or Dorothy Day or Martin of Tours or lots of people. So I wasn't claiming this as Lutheran. I was claiming Raleigh Martinson says if you look in all of Luther's writings, there are 4 points, and I have found them helpful and just decided that would give me something to keep pegging on while I'm at Holden, because this is the first teaching I've done in spirituality. So, but I think you're right. I would not place this as a Lutheran, as a Luther symbol or thing that we're working with gentle justice in the middle. It's about 2 minutes till lunch. I'll let you, then we're going to break.
One thing that has to come out, I haven't heard, is forgiveness.
Yeah.
We forgive as we are forgiven.
Uh-huh.
We're all bastards, but we're forgiven.
Yes, right.
And in that sense, we have the power to forgive.
Thank you. Yeah, that's stronger in the story than I made it today. It's very strong in the story, and so don't blame Will Campbell, blame me. I want to tell you one last, it can be a very heavy thing when you look, Dan Spencer will do Central America again this week, and when you take a look at the violence in the world, and tomorrow we look at global injustice, it can be a very heavy thing. So let me end with one story that continues to inspire me from years ago here at Holden. John Nelson lives in Seattle. His mother, Ruth Youngdahl Nelson, father, Clarence Nelson, I think you probably know of him. He's been working against the arms race for 25 years. And John always has a smile, ear to ear. And so he came up to communion, grinning from ear to ear. And after the communion service, I went over and said, John, do you realize that you've been working against the arms race for 25 years and things are worse now than they were 25 years ago? He said, oh, yeah, yeah. And I said, well, then why do you keep smiling? And he got another grin from ear to ear, and he says, because I know how the story ends.